Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD-HD. Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios Wayne Thompson, who is an associate professor of sociology and criminal justice at Carthage College. He's been there since 1998. And Professor Thompson has been frequently a guest on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, particularly on the Joy Cardine Show. And they really enjoy having Professor Thompson on to speak to a number of different issues related to American culture and kind of shifts in cultural demographics and sort of the way our sort of corporate life, our life as a nation sort of seems to be sweeping. And he follows various shifts in the way we live, the way we view the world, through the prism of a sociologist. And I'm always intrigued by the fact that, in a sense, the work that Professor Thompson does is so much about numbers and yet so much about people. And so he's really in the business of helping to understand us as human beings and how we interact with one another and live together and fight together and looking at the numbers in the most perceptive and careful kind of ways. Because, of course, anybody who follows things like presidential elections knows that numbers can be bandied about in very, very careless and even destructive ways. And it's really a pleasure to sit across the table from someone who knows as much as he does and cares about getting at the root of the most important issues confronting us. So, Professor Wayne Thompson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you here. Let me ask you, first of all, a question similar to what I asked Professor Jonathan Shaler, who is at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, on the program recently. We had a conversation about the rhetoric of this current presidential campaign, particularly between the two major party candidates. And I asked him something to the effect of, how has he been experiencing this current extraordinary presidential campaign, personally and professionally? I mean, like, where does one leave off and the other go? I mean, in terms of your own roles as just American citizen interested in his own country versus, in your case, a sociologist, I should think you really follow all of this with a certain special delight and fascination.
Yes, well, like all Americans right now, we are in the midst of a contested terrain. And what my interest is in the cultural side of it, especially, but also the demographics that drive that. So looking more at the underlying tensions and, sources of identity and how that overlaps between politics, especially politics and religion and other parts of the culture is the prism through which I would look at that. And that means to point attention more toward the audience than toward the candidates, in a way. Mm. So for me, when I hear the candidates, it evokes images of people listening out in the audience. So similar with your radio audience, the show is not really a matter of what's going on in the studio. It's also a matter of how people are perceiving it and digesting information and relating that to what's going on in their lives. More broadly, similarly in the political realm, when Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump give a speech, give a talk, I'm almost more interested in how it's received by the public and how it resonates with them. So
right.
That's the prism through which I look.
Fascinating. So, for instance, when let's just say when Donald Trump says something especially provocative and newsworthy, as he so often does, you are, in a sense, less interested in whatever that statement was than you are in those who either receive it rapturously or those who recoil in horror, and what's going on inside of them that leads
yes.
them to respond in the way that they do.
Well, and especially in terms of the social networks, because after a speech is given, after the 24-hour news cycle brings something out, most often with Donald Trump, but also for the Clinton side, and it was true during the primaries as well with Bernie Sanders, then comes the social networking and the sharing in communities. You can imagine in communities like ours, people go down to, I think it's the Coffee Pot or Frank's Diner and start to jawbone a little bit about it. That's the dimension that I'm interested in, how people digest the information, how they respond to it. I'll give you an example of that with from the Trump side, the use of the term political correctness. I wonder, you know, how do people process that and think about that term? What does that really mean to them? It has a lot of emotional connotations, and especially, I think, on the conservative side of things. But on the liberal side, for that audience and those social networks, the concept may mean something quite different, taken more as an insult on the liberal side. And that's often the reaction, you know, well, it's a dog whistle for the insiders on the Trump side, and it's a slam on say, you know, feminists or intellectuals, something like that. You know, are they attacking Black Lives Matter? You know, so I wonder about how people receive that and respond to that particular term, but also the rhetoric of the speeches that are given. And now we have another round coming up, too, with the debates. I think we're about a month out from getting into the debate part of it, so we'll have even more to chew on there. The back and forth, the banter between the candidates is one level you can look at. But how people are talking about it in mainstream America and reacting to the rhetoric is something I'm much more interested in.
Right. Talking about that for a second, I should think it's an amazing new world for somebody like you and your colleagues, in that you have all of the riches / chaos of the social media world to access, in order to get at the heart of how people are, for instance, responding to a given speech by candidate A or candidate B. I mean, that is information, in a sense, much more readily available than it would have been 20 or 30 years ago.
Yes.
That being said, that presents its own challenges, I should think, in terms of how to navigate that whole crowded world and how to make sense of all that you're seeing and hearing.
And not really well understood. The study of social media in a systematic way and how political culture, how other dimensions of our culture are being discussed and contested through social media is something I don't think social scientists really have a good grasp on. Research on social media is new because social media is new. It's a new mode of communication. What we do know from social media studies, though, is that there tend to be, over time, people will block friends, for instance, on Facebook, or will find more of what is sometimes referred to as an echo chamber. That is, people will tend toward communicating with those who agree with them. And therefore, you know, if you go bird's eye on it, that means that there's a certain element of social isolation within narrative bubbles and not a lot of cross-fertilization. The impact on our democracy is, I don't think, is as well fleshed out as it could be or will be in the future as far as the impact of social media because of that. But what we do know, of course, is that we are inhabiting this separate worlds now where people tend to interact on social media with people who agree with them increasingly. And therefore, Americans, at least through social media, are not having that kind of cross-fertilization that might have happened across backyard fences and in church parking lots in the past.
Hmm. I wonder about that, to what extent that is true. I happen to be someone on Facebook who, I don't want to spell out exactly what I am politically, but I will say that most of my Facebook friends align relatively closely with who I am and what I believe in, but by no means all. And as much as I really am sometimes really disconcerted by some of what is expressed by people who see the world very differently, and for instance, this presidential campaign very differently than I do, I appreciate having those voices as part of my Facebook wall. I appreciate hearing what they're saying and knowing what they're thinking, and once in a while we engage in a little zing, zing, zing. But I suspect that I might be in the minority there, and that far more people gravitate to the model that you're talking about. Although sometimes the people who end up being our Facebook friends are not people we actively recruit because they believe we are. It's because we work at the same place or
have some other kind of interest.
Right, or we're related to them.
Related to them, exactly. Yeah, so the impact of social media on the political culture certainly is not really all that well understood. The way that most social scientists, the common modality for social scientists like myself, for learning about what's going on in our culture is public opinion polls. It's still the main way, but also focus groups. Public opinion polls are very good in terms of being able to generalize to large groups of people, but they lack depth. What social scientists call validity isn't as good. And so in order to go deeper, more deeply, there is no substitute for sitting in, like the sign in the New England coffee shop that I used to go to when I was a University of Connecticut student, put it, sit long, talk much. Right? And so you really do have to sit and talk to people, but there is a kind of polarization in our culture that makes that difficult. And because of the separate social networks that we often inhabit, liberals, conservatives, moderates, there is a huge moderate contingent out there in our culture as far as, you know, politics and social issues, but that isn't as sort of sexy and racy for the media. That shows up in public opinion polls, but in order to get any depth, we need, you know, the focus groups and see people play off of other opinions and how they interact. And so that's the most common modality for social scientists to understand public opinion. The difference there, I think, from social media, looking at public opinion polls and focus groups, is that you do tend to see that there is a much larger moderate voice out there than most Americans realize, and that would be sort of make for good cable TV news, right? It's the polarization that makes for the good news.
And so, in other words, that's all we talk about. That tends to be all
we talk about.
We talk about the sharp divide between us. And in fact, when you think about all those moderates in the middle, in a sense, suddenly the United States doesn't look at all the same as that other picture where there is this enormous, uncrossable chasm between two bitterly divided sides.
Well, there are also folks who, in terms of cultural tensions, current cultural tensions, the so-called culture wars, that are sort of dropped out from that, right, that have other kinds of concerns, or they view their political and social stands as more of a private matter, right, and so they're not constantly wearing it on their sleeve. These are the people that are not always watching Fox News or MSNBC, right? There may be, I think about on Wisconsin Ideas Network, they have some political content and social issues programming, but one of the most popular shows is Calling All Pets.
Yeah.
You know, and the People's Pharmacy or Larry Mueller's Garden Show. So there are a lot of people that are interested in polarization. There is polarization, but indeed, there is this vast middle out there in our culture that that will come into play, of course, in the election as well. Right now, there's concern about where the moderates are going to cut in terms of the presidential election, in terms of some, in Wisconsin, certainly the Senate race. And where does the middle go? Well, with Donald Trump, there's a lot of concern among the middle that it's sort of shifted away from him because of some of the more strident nationalist kinds of utterance and some of the things that happened at the rally, some of the more expressive dimensions, fighting with some of the protesters and so on. And so I think the moderates are going to be playing a role in the election. We'll be hearing more from them. And right now, that group is not cutting toward Donald Trump. They're cutting toward Hillary Clinton, even though Hillary Clinton has high negatives in the polls, right? She rates as unfavorable at about 43. I'm sure I've got it right in front of me with my glasses. Let's see. Clinton, positive views of Clinton, only 43%.
Right.
But positive views of Trump, 33%. And I think that's where the moderate group comes in, that the moderates have kind of been cutting, trending against support for Donald Trump. We see that inside certain factions of the Republican Party. Congressman Ryan, for instance, comes out in support of Donald Trump, but not very warmly, you see. And not that he's a part of the moderate group, right? But I'm talking here more about how this is received and what it is a bellwether about. And I think it's a bellwether that some of the more strident dimensions of the political talk in this presidential election have disadvantaged Donald Trump because the moderates have kind of abandoned him right now.
Right. And for instance, Speaker Ryan might or might not be himself characterized as a moderate, but certainly he's aware of the moderates and their significance and is trying to express himself and, for instance, his support for Donald Trump's in terms that might be palatable to that block of moderate Republicans.
Well, I think especially on race talk, you know, the demographics are shifting in the United States. In, I think it was in 1980, that 12% of eligible voters were non-whites. It's now 28%. And so very strident nationalist talk that's kind of racially tinged is maybe kind of a turnoff for a lot of people right now because more of the population is non-white, or there's more interaction between whites and non-whites than there used to be. We live less in the segregated worlds than we did. And so I think along racial lines, many white moderates have been turned off by some of the more strident things that Trump has said and some of the behavior at the rallies, some of the what could be characterized as white nationalism.
Right. And its statements ideas and concepts that, on the other hand, other Republicans are very excited about, and in a sense, he is playing to that particular segment of the population, but in a sense, at his political peril, antagonizing a lot of moderates.
Well, yes, and I think that it isn't your grandfather's Republican Party anymore. That in the era of Reagan, forward from 1980 forward, certainly. There would be some coded language regarding race, talk about welfare queens and so on. But I think that the Trump contingent, the support for Trump, the more white nationalist end of it, are not traditionally Republicans. These are a lot of people who weren't in the political process at all. So on the one hand, Donald Trump has brought a lot of people into the political process who weren't very politically active. And into the Republican side of it. But on the other hand, a lot of more moderate Republicans have been turned off by that. And I think also with millennials, younger generations, there is not very much enthusiasm for Donald Trump, even among those who grew up and continue to identify as Republicans. So what we see is, are we seeing a breakup of the Republican Party? that might be an overstatement, I think, because this election, if you think about it, is going to come and it's going to go, and people will pick up the remnants there. But certainly it's not the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan anymore. And with the Democrats, there's been clearly a lot of growth. I mean, the Democrat side benefits from younger voters, from college-educated, you know, certainly, and minorities. That's kind of the Democratic niche. And that's relatively stable, and that's growing. You know, one statistic I uncovered in my research for this interview was that every election cycle, white, non-college-educated, as part of the eligible voter block, that declines by 3% every four-year election cycle, whereas white, college-educated increases by 4% of the eligible voters every election cycle. So the demographics are cutting toward the Democrats, away from Republicans, at least for recent elections, and right. Certainly we're seeing it this time.
Yeah. On the other hand, I've been thinking about, as I saw that statistic, and I found that really fascinating, it got me thinking about something else, which is not directly related to who's college educated or not, because that is, of course, a significant factor in this election. But it also got me thinking about the fact that if younger voters tend to sweep Democratic, that seems like a very, very positive sign for the Democratic Party and a sign of worry for the Republican Party. On the other hand, overall, our population is aging. We have more and more older people making up a larger and larger proportion of our population because our birth rate is so low and people are living longer and so on. Is that in any way then something that the Democrats should be worried about, that there are more and more older voters out there who might tend to sweep towards more conservative beliefs and or the Republican Party?
And also more religious. You know, the older voters tend to be more religious. Minority voters tend to be more religious on average. College-educated splits. So among younger people, college-educated, some of them form this, you know, fastest-growing religion in the United States is no religion, right? So younger college-educated people are a huge block of that contingent. So there are some cross-currents and cross-tensions here. Religion is one factor. Race is a factor here. And so if you look, I think the best thing to do is back up and look at what parts of the population are growing, what parts are declining. The aging of the baby boomers certainly favors traditional Republicans, but traditional Republicans, really, who are they now after the Donald Trump era, right? And so overall, the trends do favor the Democrats. Younger, minorities, immigrants, Asian immigrants. You know, the fastest growing racial group in the United States isn't Latinos. It is Asians. We don't see as much of that in the Midwest,
right.
But certainly on the West Coast and nationally, there's a huge growth in Asians from now up to close to 4%, I think, for the Asian population, up from about 1% in the 1970. So the Asian contingent is growing. Latinos are now 16%, if you count undocumented folks too, so probably around there, around 16%, and growing to as much as 30% by 2050. So there are racial shifts going on, and the black population is slowly growing. The white population, indeed, is declining and is smaller, and the college-educated population is growing. So there are a lot of cross-currents there. I think what will happen in the future is that what was recognized by a lot of Republican leaders in 2012 when they put out a kind of autopsy of the Republican Party, and it's amazing to see that the predictions of decline did not lead to shifts in the Republican Party, other than maybe a shift to harder to the right and toward more conservative.
You mean did not lead to a shift in policy, for instance, or
yes.
Rhetorical color, that kind of thing.
Exactly. But you wonder if the Republicans are going to have to put out different products on the shelf in order to appeal to the millennial generation. As my grandfather, who lived in Burlington, Wisconsin, what he used to tell me is, where I stand today, you stand tomorrow. And that is that there will be demographic succession here, and you have to appeal to the voters where they are. Instead, what the more conservative wings of the Republican Party have tried to do is to try to change how they do the persuasion, right? How to get conversions, talk a little bit differently to minorities, to younger people, but not shift the policy positions. I think in the future you will see a shifting of policy positions. So, for instance, I wonder, would there be, what would that mean? Would there be a softening of the anti-abortion policies on the Republican side? It could be that we could see something like that. Certainly a shift on the gay issue. And Donald Trump's interesting in that regard because you don't hear anti-gay rhetoric from Donald Trump. It's not entirely clear where those policy shifts go, but it's sort of like selling detergent. If the people in the population are not buying the traditional detergent you've been putting on the shelf, you have to sell a different kind of detergent or you'll be out of business. Mm. This is the dilemma facing the Republican Party. The Democrats have a product line that emphasizes social justice, emphasizes inclusion of historically excluded groups in the United States. I'm not sure that they're under as much pressure to change, if you will, their product line as the Republicans are going to be in the future. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Dr. Wayne Thompson, Associate Professor of Sociology and Criminal Justice at Carthage College. Professor Thompson, I think I just came up with something that I think perhaps helps clarify the prism through which you look at something like this current presidential campaign versus somebody who is more of a political scientist. I'm thinking, for instance, of the primary group that supports Donald Trump, the Republican candidate, namely whites, males, and without a college degree. Mm-hmm. That is the slice of the American population that appears to be most fervently supportive of Donald Trump, 45 years or older, and small town and rural. That is the core of his powerhouse support. If I'm not mistaken, I think what you as a sociologist are more interested in than, for instance, your colleagues in the political science department is why. What is going on inside the mind of that white male down in Arkansas or Kansas or wherever he lives?
Yes.
What is going on in his life? What's going on inside his mind, his heart, that leads him to a candidate like Donald Trump? What is the resonance there?
Yes, and well, in particular, most of my research is on religion, and indeed, I was on the research staff of the Presbyterian Church USA, then the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and also I worked for the Archdiocese of New York City. So I had, through the church, I often look at it through not only church politics, but also the religious culture. So for sociology, we're interested more in how all the different parts of culture and society interrelate. So it's kind of, very lively. Makes me think of a juggler with several balls in the air,
yeah.
Or the people who used to spin the plates and they'd have to keep the plates going. Whereas political science or economics tends to be focused more on one part of the culture and the social structure. Sociologists are interested in how the whole rich potpourri all works in ensemble. And for me in particular in religion, I think if we look at small town and rural America, and I did grow up in small town, as I know you did, in the Midwest. I grew up in Marshfield, Wisconsin, where farm culture was still in the 1970s was still kind of the left the most important mark. There was some manufacturing and so on, but small town and rural America, everywhere you go, you see a sense of loss, a sense of mourning, And some of the studies of what goes on inside the churches in these communities, which are very important seminal institutions in the small towns, and there may not be even gas stations or grocery stores anymore, but the church, it becomes the, sort of the focus of community life. So when we study what goes on in small town and rural churches, I think you get a little bit of a clue or an answer to your concern there, a question. One analysis I've seen of sermons in small town and rural churches is that there's this emphasis on a lot of talk about the crucifixion of Christ, right? A lot of emphasis, which is at the core of Christianity, of course, but especially recently, there's a lot of talk about that. Well, that, I think, channels some of the sense of suffering, of loss, of mourning. Crucifixion is symbolic of that. And also a lot of talk about the resurrection in these overwhelmingly Christian communities, in their churches. The resurrection of Jesus is sort of symbolic in many ways of the attempts to resurrect small town and community life, which is seen to be declining. Now, viewed from the other side, that is through, say, the eyes of college-educated, urban, Gen X and millennials, they might say, well, they have a different look, and that is that that America, United States, used to be more white, 80% white in 1980, 62% white now, and that, therefore, there is a need to share power, and there's a need to share the society with an increase in social and cultural pluralism. So a different kind of prism, right? It's not about loss and mourning. It's for the college-educated urbanites, younger folks, minorities, immigrants, it's about possibility and what might be possible if those white people would only share the country, right? So it's a different set of experiences growing up in a small town. And indeed, that is where the support is for Donald Trump, for conservative candidates in the political culture, and for a broader ethos of, you know, everyday life is viewed as a matter of America being taken away from them. So it depends on your experiences, where you sit. It depends on your social networks. It depends, I guess, where you go for breakfast in the morning and what people are talking about across the table as they're drinking their coffee.
That's so interesting. And, you know, I'm thinking about the small town where I, especially the small town where I went to high school. And without a doubt, it was a largely conservative community and a largely conservative church, for instance, that I attended. But on the other hand, it was not across the board. There were people in that community and in that church who were quite liberal. And what's interesting is what happens now in this day and age in terms of people speaking up and how much frank conversation occurs across party lines. And do we see, you know, in the church parking lot more of a congealing of a sort of falling in step with those who already agree with you versus having conversations of one kind or another with people who see the world a little differently and who might throw up red flags about somebody who you thought was great or whatever. What is your sense of how much those kind of conversations are occurring now in modern America?
Well, I think
America?
They're occurring less. And we were talking before the show a little bit about Alexis de Tocqueville was a French diplomat that visited the United States in the 1830s and saw that what made us a lively democracy were those kinds of conversations, the ability to, you know, talk in the through public venues in the town square, right, back in New England. I think about the town squares where we could come together and you would interact with the community across income lines, across educational lines. We were more united. And certainly that was the case after World War II in the United States in the 1950s. As we got into the Civil Rights era, though, we started to see more that there were fissures along racial lines, certainly. Then along came in the 1970s and 80s, we saw the rise of the feminist movement. The Equal Rights Amendment was kind of a focus there. And now gay rights, LGBTQ rights. So there are fissures in our culture now, but as far as us coming together, as I look at it, I study it through religious culture, so it's focused on the churches. We see an increasing division there. The division recently has been over the gay issue, as I said, gay ministers, and now gay same-sex marriage ceremonies. And the reaction there is conservatives are simply leaving mainline churches, founding their own denominations, or joining more conservative denominations. And so that discussion happens at a lower level. That's particularly painful for the mainline Protestants, whose emphasis has been on the body of Christ, right? We should be together. We should find a way to be together. And yet we're not together. Increasingly, we're seeing schisms and people pulling out from the churches. You think about what are the other venues, really, to cross over ideological lines. There aren't a lot of venues for that. The church was one place. So if the church becomes more divided, and certainly we are racially divided in our churches, Martin Luther King pointed out that the most racially segregated hour in America is Sunday morning. So we're divided racially in the churches. Now we're starting to see an ideological divide. It used to be, though, that the churches were divided by social class, and that certainly is also true by social class, by race. Now we have this ideological division. And so if the churches aren't a place where we can have these conversations across and learn more about what other people think and feel, people who are different than ourselves, I think that there is a declining public space for that. It isn't like you can go to the mall and strike up a, you know, political conversation. Both sides will get chased out by management,
right. Yeah, right, exactly. Especially in this hotly contested election, that's for sure. You shared a lot of interesting information about the religious framework of really all of our presidents, all of whom in one way or another, even very vaguely, have all been Christian, of course. But of course the intensity of that identification, you know, varies widely, and some people are really kind of a crazy quilt of sort of different influences and have identified themselves in different ways. Briefly, because we're starting to run out of time, what is your sense of the power of, first of all, Mr. Trump, in terms of the Republican base, which generally speaking is more religious, where religion is identified as a more important factor, his own religious identification or profile being not particularly strong. I think most people would agree about that. What do you think is the key to the success that he has had with that portion of the Republican Party?
Yes. Well, if you look back at the primary season, the Protestant evangelicals were supporting Ted Cruz for the most part. Trump had much less support. So the Protestant evangelicals had their person, their candidate. He lost. And in June, just in this past June, Donald Trump went to speak to the National Association of Christian Evangelicals. I forget the exact name of it, but the largest organization. And Jerry Falwell Jr., if you remember Jerry Falwell from the Moral Majority, his son is kind of a maker and shaker in the evangelical world. And Jerry Falwell Jr. came out in support of Trump, saying that, well, he's a baby Christian. He's been converted now. I'm not sure when this conversion came, but
Nothing he talks about, certainly.
No, it's not something he talks about. But the evangelical right, to some extent, is characterizing Trump as evangelical Protestant. No, his background in history was as a Presbyterian, so sort of vaguely Reformed Protestant, who talks about 2 Corinthians as 2 Corinthians. So I don't think Mr. Trump has as much maybe, you know, religious upbringing wasn't as as much as Ted Cruz, who was the son of a Baptist preacher. What's the convergence there? What is the interest? Why are evangelical Protestants and conservative Catholics lining up behind Donald Trump? Well, the reason is that there's an overlap in Christian nationalism, the project of the Jerry Falwell Jr.'s in the evangelical Protestant world is to make the United States a Christian nation. Donald Trump talks about nationalism, it's sort of at the core, And I suppose the evangelicals are saying that's enough, they can work with that, right? Mm. So that is the interest. So they're kind of elevating him to a born-again Christian.
And in a sense, it speaks to the same urge, or that speaks to the same sense of loss, even though in a sense it's characterized differently, but it's speaking to the same
fear. The nation is changing and so on, and there isn't a common core of values. We need a common core of values that unites our culture. And so they point to Christianity in that way. At the same time, keep in mind that the United States is becoming less Christian. Since 1965, the immigrants that have been coming into the United States have been predominantly Catholic, a lot of Latinos, but a lot of non-Christians as well, Hindus, Muslims. We're about 1.3% Muslim now in the United States, compared to 10% in Europe. So the tension around non-Christians and this issue of Christian nation has to be viewed in perspective. It still is predominantly a Christian country, but as I said earlier, the fastest growing religion, no religion at all. So Donald Trump is in a position to capitalize on the nationalistic aspects of the agenda for conservative Christians.
Quickly about Hillary Clinton, her own religious identification is a little bit complicated in terms of how she grew up versus once she married Bill Clinton. So she is this mix of, by background, Methodist, but through marriage, Baptist, and so on. Does any of that even matter, given the fact that that religion seems to be a little less of at least a foreground issue for many on the liberal side?
I think it does, because if you listen to who's talking about religion in this presidential race, it's Hillary Clinton, and emphasizing her Methodist background. So she went from, you know, strong Methodist to somewhat nominally Baptist when she was first lady, when Bill Clinton was president, and they weren't particularly religiously active at that time. Now she's again emphasizing her Methodist identity and her upbringing. The United Methodists, of course, that she identifies with, social justice. And I think that that appeals inside the Democratic Party to, especially to African Americans, who tend to be more religious on average. Many of them are Baptist, but there are over 2 million black Catholics now, too. Hmm. But so I think that that is, makes an internal appeal inside the Democratic Party and gives a profile of the Democrats as less a-religious or anti-religious. And so that's a shift from previous elections. I would also reference back to Jimmy Carter, who's probably the most religiously oriented, religiously committed president in my lifetime anyway.
Hmm. By quite a margin, actually, I should think.
And a social justice Baptist at that, so...
Right,
not necessarily a contradiction, but a little unusual.
Right, yeah. And I was telling you before we went on the air, I remain astounded that was talked about so little at the time and since, actually.
It's important to who Jimmy Carter is.
Absolutely.
So.
Let's finish out by talking about some numbers. I appreciated that you shared some of the most current poll numbers across the country that include significant margins for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump, particularly when we look at the certain swing states that are quite crucial. What I really wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking about are the numbers here in Wisconsin. You quoted the Marquette Law School poll as saying that Clinton is leading Donald Trump by 9% for all adults, and by 15% over in likely voters over Donald Trump. And then you shared some numbers also in which Russ Feingold is showing a significant lead over Ron Johnson,
a little smaller than
right,
than
but,
that presidential
but, right, but significant nevertheless. I wonder what your sense is as a sociologist about what's going on, what is behind these numbers here in Wisconsin that are even stronger for Hillary Clinton than the numbers that she has from the nation overall.
It's difficult sometimes to extrapolate, even though it's tempting to say it's something about being a swing state. Wisconsin is now viewed as a purple state, red state, Republican, blue state, Democrat. Purple state, These are the so-called swing states. I think what it does mean right now is that Wisconsin probably is not a swing state in this current election cycle. Hmm. And so what are the dynamics here? Wisconsin does have Wisconsin has a Republican legislature, Republican governor, and that is likely to continue. And that has been a Republican strategy in a number of states to emphasize, you know, local elections, statewide elections, and they've been very successful with that. There are gerrymandering factors there with making the districts kind of election-proof, which is why there's no serious challenge to Paul Ryan ever since he was elected, really, but especially now. And so what is it with why is Wisconsin ahead? Well, we see the Democrats ahead, or Clinton ahead, certainly also in Pennsylvania, and also by similar margins, by quite a bit. I think, as a sociologist, I see it's the moderate and independent, so-called independent, most of the independents lean one way or the other anyway, but the sort of independent-leaning Republican, the independent-leaning Democrat, whatever that spectrum is, and the moderate part of the population, I think, has rejected some of the more strident rhetoric that you've heard coming from the some of the Trump rallies, some of the violence against the protesters at the rallies, some of the language that's been used, some of the more racial polarization may have been being rejected by Wisconsin voters. It's just a guess, but it's okay to make guesses because mm-hmm. we will see on Election Day whether or not that was a factor.
I'm also curious, since you care so much about the role that religion plays, do you find anything surprising, perhaps even astonishing, about the success of Russ Feingold, who, of course, was our U.S. Senator for many years and now leads the current incumbent who unseated him, Ron Johnson? Do you find anything remarkable about the fact that he is a man of the Jewish faith and does nothing to obscure that as part of his identity, and yet does so very well in a place like Wisconsin?
It is amazing to watch. You know, in the 1990s, one of the best trivia questions when people would play trivia is, which state has two Jewish senators? And the answer was Wisconsin, because Herb Kohl also was Jewish. Hmm. Russ Feingold was Jewish. And indeed, Russ Feingold is a member of the Kenosha Beth Hillel Temple, where his sister, Dana Feingold, is our longtime rabbi here in Kenosha. But in Wisconsin as a whole, this is a very Catholic state, about 50 to 60% Catholic, and about 25% to 30% Lutheran. Well, that's almost everybody right there. So why would a overwhelmingly Catholic and Lutheran state vote for Jews? And I think back to the Lafala tradition and the independence of Wisconsin. There's a long kind of cantankerous spirit here of independence in Wisconsin. So I look at that tradition, and I'm not surprised. We also have an openly lesbian senator in Tammy Baldwin. So Wisconsin has a history of being a little bit off trend in with respect to with religion and with the culture and background of some of our politicians. We're a purple state, and I think